Tonight on Arena, Denise Goff on her role in the new ITV series Too Close and Natalia O'Flaherty on Speaking the Words of James Joyce. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Last night on ITV, we saw the first part of a new three-part drama called Too Close. This is an adaptation of Natalie Daniels' 2019 thriller of the same name about a forensic psychiatrist, Emma, played by Emily Watson, who's trying to assess whether Connie, played by Denise Goff, is fit to stand trial. Connie claims to have no memory of the night when she drove her car off a bridge with two small children inside. Is she the yummy mummy murderer the tabloids are painting her as, or is she a disturbed and desperate one? Delighted to be joined by Denise Goff from London this evening. A yummy mummy monster, yummy mummy murderer. That's quite a character to take on, Denise.
Yeah, I love it. It was, it's in keeping with all the other roles I play.
Which bit, the yummy mummy bit, the murderer or the monster?
The murderer, the monster, the whole lot, Sean, the whole lot.
But there must have been something you don't, well, maybe you do go in saying, yeah, do I want to play a yummy mummy murderer? What is it when you read a script about a character like Connie, what are you looking for, Denise? What's the key that attracts you into a character like that?
Well, I mean, I didn't even notice that really the yummy mummy monster reading it. That wasn't what stood out to me. What stood out was, I mean, it's an incredible part for any actor to have. But I wasn't at a stage where it was up to me whether I would play it or not. You know, it was offered to a couple of my peers first and eventually kind of made its way to me. And then there was the usual audition process. So I would love to, I guess I'm sort of getting to the stage where I get to read things and say, oh, this is what I want to do. But I had to fight for this part just like any other. And I fought for it because I get to do every possible thing in this show. And also, you don't know, it's a very interesting thing, this yummy mummy monster, because it's how we report on women in the press, you know. You've no idea what has gone on in this woman's life. And so it's a kind of three episodes of discovering that.
Yeah, and I suppose even take the word monster out of that. It's so easy to dismiss any person. Oh, look, there's a yummy mummy. And that's it. Yeah. You've labelled them. That's them sorted. You don't need to think anything more about them. You've got them in a little box where you want them to stay.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it just challenges all the things that we, because when you meet her, she's so kind of horrendous in that first episode. So you instantly, at least I hope, people take a real dislike. And it shows what we do with people, you know, based on what they look like or what they have done, we can write them off pretty quickly. And what I hope this show will then do is sort of tease you as to whether you're right or not to write her off so quickly.
Can you do that as an actor? Can you like or dislike a character?
Yeah, of course. I don't like everyone I play. I don't believe in that whole... I think you have to find some level of understanding and acceptance in them. But yeah, come on. I mean, the parts I play, I can't like all of them.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of Paula. I think this the last time we spoke, in fact, was about Paula and the BBC series. And she was a bit of work as well. On the surface, she was a bit of work. But actually, when you get in underneath it, she wasn't... Yeah, she was a bit of work, but she had reasons to be a bit of work. It's the same with Connie.
Exactly. I mean, human beings are endlessly fascinating to me because they're not just one thing all of the time. And I think the idea of people being goodies and baddies is so kind of ingrained in us. And actually, things are far more complex than that. And so that's what I seek. You know, you ask what I look for in a part, and it would be that. You know, I don't really get drawn to things that are quite simplistically one way. I like things to be more complex because we are more complex and we're all doing the best we can with what's available to us, even when we do horrendous things, you know. But I don't have to like all my characters. I don't believe that we have to do that in order to be able to play them.
One of the great dynamics in the piece, in this new work, Too Close, in the new three-part series, is the relationship that starts to develop between Connie, your character, and the forensic psychiatrist Emma, played by Emily Watson. This is, it's a real case of Connie really knows how to turn the tables on Emma.
Yeah, and also you have to remember too, like Connie would have seen the film Silence of the Lambs, you know? She's got access to, you know, she's playing in order to avoid having to take responsibility or to avoid, you know, things like dissociative amnesia can be ways to avoid dealing with trauma that have happened. So she's doing everything she can to deflect, you know, that's a huge thing for her. And so she employs all those kind of techniques that you see in those relationships between like interviewers and their interviewees, you know, yeah, we see it all the time. It makes for good drama, doesn't it?
So Connie is the kind of Hannibal Lecter of this particular dynamic.
Yeah. I tried to do that thing, you know, that I tried, but they wouldn't let me.
I wonder why. Let's have a listen to a clip. This is very early on in the first episode. In fact, it's the first meeting between Connie, your character, Denise, and the psychiatrist, Emma, played by Emma Watson.
Mm-hmm. Go on. Have a good look. I would. How on earth did her life go so wrong? Quite easily, as it happens. So you better watch out with your swishy bag and your sensible shoes. You could be next.
It's my job to keep you safe, to treat you. And the court have asked for my opinion of your mental state on the night of the offence.
We need to find out why you are unable to recall the events of that night.
Scene there from Too Close, Emma, played by Emily Watson, and Connie, played by Denise Goff. And Denise speaking with me this evening from London. A very interesting line in the midst of that scene as well. You're not only, for me at any rate, Denise, was Connie addressing the character of Emma with her swishy shoes, her swishy bag and her fancy shoes, etc., etc. She warns, she's kind of telling us all, life can fall apart quite easily in front of your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on a global scale, look at the last year. We have no idea what's coming down the road. And I think things like mental health, particularly, I think there but for the grace of whatever you stand by or believe in, you know, I think it's very easy to think things will happen to other people. But how do we know? You know, so it's good to kind of have an awareness of that when you're dealing with somebody.
Yeah, there's a touch of check your privileges about the life can fall apart quite easily, that statement, yeah, isn't there?
Totally, you know. So, I think that's something that this highlights as well, you know. Because you live in a fancy house and you have all the trappings doesn't mean you're not susceptible to the same sort of breakdowns that other people are.
We last spoke around the time of Paula, which was just before you won your second Olivia Award, Miss Denise Goff, because I spoke to you when you won your first Olivia Award back in 2017. In fact, what I remember most about that conversation was you were playing was that character called Emma? Actually, funnily enough, I can't remember now.
Yeah, in People, Places, and
Things. She was called Emma. The irony of it, that not the same name as now, but the same name as the Emily Watson character now. However, yeah. Emma was this, you know, drug befuddled actor, and you had to go through, in my mind at any rate, quite an emotional journey in that play. And I spoke to you at that time when we used to be able to go to a theatre and sit in the theatre and watch things happening in the theatre. I had to speak to you before. We couldn't do it live because you were about to go on stage. But we did it like kind of maybe at 6:30 or 6:27 or something like that.
Yeah.
And you were in the
state. I'm not big on preparation, Sean.
I'd say you do the preparation for the rehearsals and all that, but you don't believe in this kind of get yourself into a zone. You don't do this type of thing at all.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how I'm feeling at the time. I don't try to follow any one fixed thing because, like anything else, I think if you get too used to doing one thing and you think you can't do it without that specific sort of, like, I heard something recently, a friend of mine who had worked with Daniel Day-Lewis said that he had said to her, you know, I really wish I could do it another way, but I can't, because I learned really early to do it this way. And so he's superstitious about sort of changing anything. So I just don't stick to any one routine when preparing anything, because I don't like to be superstitious.
Yeah, so you're superstitious about being superstitious. So to avoid being superstitious, you change the way you approach it.
I change it all the time. Sometimes I'll be able to do an interview at 6:30 before a show. Sometimes I won't, but I won't put any kind of rules or strict regulations on myself, except to make sure that I've eaten earlier and drank loads of water. That's basically.
I suppose. It. Yeah,
and those but are not too much water in case I have to eat on stage.
All the vital details that are
all the vital details.
But I remember in that interview around the time of the winning of the first Olivia. Now, obviously, Paula must have been happening probably around the same time or very shortly after that. But you said to me at that time about, I said, well, is it theatre all the way for you? And you did express a great love for theatre, but you did hope that the Olivia Award would start to open up more television. And then the second one which was for Angels in America, wasn't it? Has it opened up on you a different type of work to you now that maybe wasn't there before?
Yeah, I mean, this role is something that usually I would only get to play on stage, you know, this, what I'm doing in Too Close. And there's no doubt that even though I would never suggest anyone particularly make their theatre career about winning awards, but they, unfortunately, that's the kind of world we live in, where we kind of put a lot of value onto those things. And so, and it did help me for sure to get the kind of roles I was getting on stage, to get them on screen, because, you know, I love doing screen work, but if the part is better on stage, I'm going to take the part on the stage, you know, because it's about my satisfaction, not necessarily yours. But since, I mean, now I can do whatever I want, which is the greatest luxury ever, and it's all I've ever wanted. But the main thing that I can do is that I believe now that probably for the rest of my life, I can work in any theater and get plays put on. And that's what I've always wanted. This is all great. What's happening now is great, but it's also very different than, you know, it's quite exposing being on TV and being in films and stuff. It's a whole different ball game. I'm really comfy on stage. You know, I don't have to talk too much about myself or be recognized. Each one has its ups and its downs, but the stage is everything to me, everything.
Yeah, which must, I'm wondering what the emotions are around it at the moment, because obviously there's no theatre happening at the moment.
Yeah, and we're first in, last out. You know, theatre was the first to go into a lockdown and a shutdown, and it will be the last out of it. You know, we're going to need huge amounts of rehabilitation, and it's not going to happen overnight. We're not all suddenly going to be sitting in packed theatres together. It's going to be slow, and we're going to have to make sure that all the great stuff we had started doing before this happened, the pandemic happened, that we commit to continuing that, so that theatre continues, like that we can get it to wider audiences, that it doesn't continue to be such an elitist sport, if you like. You know, we were doing really well at creating, you know, £10 tickets and everything, and I worry about all of that now, because it's going to be in so much debt having been closed for so long. Will come back.
Yeah, for sure it will be back. It'll take more than that to kill it, I would have thought. What do you think about, you know, the way that we are getting things, like particularly from the National Theatre in Great Britain, where they do this, the National Theatre Live type of thing, and this is happening in more and more theatres, where the performances, if not taped, it certainly, it might be coming to us live, but we could be seeing it subsequently in a taped version. Does that open things up to audiences and new audiences? Has COVID, in fact, maybe opened the idea of going to a theatre up to people, because they could do it from their own sitting room? So now they might actually go to the theatre itself.
Well, hopefully that's what happens and that it doesn't become, oh, well, we'll just watch it from our living room. I mean, yeah. I don't think there is any substitute for being in a theater with people. Like, I get really emotional even thinking about the times that I've had and have been allowed to have in the theater and how much I miss it. And I don't want it to become... it's brilliant that we found this hybrid thing to get us through. And it's great that people can have access to plays that were filmed. But personally, for me, I want to be in a theatre. And also, you know, they film our performances, but my performance is designed for the stage. And then you put it on the telly and it's like, oh my God, why is she doing that with her face? It's so huge. So, I'm not sure I like being filmed doing stage acting and it being put on screens all over.
However,
we have it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, must do as a great master and all of the rest of it. But I'm sorry now to get you to tell this story, but I really want to hear it from your mouth as opposed to on a printed page. Meryl Streep won't be coming into your kitchen if she sees you. Now, explain why I might be talking about Meryl Streep coming to you straight after a performance.
Well, so when I was 23, it was my first big job. I did a play, an Irish play called By the Bog of Cats in the West End with Holly Hunter. And there was one night that our green room was being made very tidy and fancy, and I thought it was a party for us. And so I came bounding down the stairs after the performance, and I literally kicked the door open, and the door flew back, and then Meryl Streep was sitting on the couch and crying because the play, it's a very intense play, Irish writing, and she got up and came over to me and said, well done, congratulations. And I threw my arms around her and so nice to meet you. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm meeting Meryl Streep. And then when I pulled my arms away, her earring had gotten caught in my jumper and it ripped out of her ear. So then it was me and Meryl Streep on our knees trying to find her earring, but also me panicking that her ear was maybe, I was afraid it was bleeding. So I kept, you know, doing that thing of trying to grab her ear. So anyway, we found her earring. She was grace personified. And then as I stood up, I turned around and Jim Carrey was standing there with his hand out saying, he put his hand out and he just went, nice. Yeah. Absolutely mortified. And I had to leave. And that was my Meryl Streep story. So I don't know if she would remember that. It was 20 years ago and I'm sure it meant way more to me than it did to her, unless I did in fact maim her and then maybe she does remember. But hey, you know, it's a good way to get somebody to remember you.
When I get to interview her, it will be my very first question, Denise. Listen, I was tempted to gorge on all three parts earlier today, but there was a small matter of other stuff to get ready for the programme.
But also you can't, can you? It's not out.
Well, you see, I was lucky enough to be given previews, but I decided to hold off. I decided to hold off and watch it in the real way. So I'd be watching.
It's anxiety inducing knowing that it's happening, like every night thinking, oh God, being on terrestrial TV is such a different ball game for me. Like even Paula, I didn't feel this anxious about. Well, I hope you enjoy it.
Well, I enjoyed episode one. I'm dying to watch episodes two and three, which will be episode two is on ITV tonight and episode three tomorrow night. But for those who don't have the ITV on their television package here now, it will be on Virgin Media next month, and then you won't be able to come home after all of that because then people say, oh, that's your woman who was in, that's the yummy mummy monster. Denise, lovely as always to talk to you. Continued success. Looking forward to the third Olivia and several BAFTAs and all the rest of it. And I hope you'll always talk
to us. Also, I just wanted to just quickly say, I heard you rehearsing as I was waiting to come on. I was hearing you rehearsing what you had to say, and I thought, God, it doesn't matter who we are, we all have to go through the same thing with rehearsing.
Yeah, did you hear the 54 takes that I had to do for one thing that I was recording? Yeah.
I'm working on something at the moment where I have these lines that are just so difficult and I have to learn them in a rhythm, otherwise they won't go in. So I was very impressed. Well done.
Thank you very much for that. I'm going red. Denise, thanks a million. I hope to talk to you soon. And I hope you're back in theatre soon. Hope to see you home in Ireland at some point soon as well. Denise Goff there. Too Close, as I said, the name of the series. It continues on ITV tonight and tomorrow. But we certainly be watching out for it. Do watch out for it when it comes, if you don't have ITV on your television package, when it comes to Virgin Media. And that will be next month. Arena. 7:24 on Tuesday night's Arena. Through the medium of spoken word music and videography, Ulysses 2021 will tell the story of a modern Dublin. It's part of the Music Town Festival, will be performed by the Word Up Collective. And delighted now to be joined by spoken word artist Natalia O'Flaherty, who will be part of that event. Just tell us a little bit about what's involved in the overall project, Ulysses 2021, and how the work of James Joyce is inspiring it, Natalia.
Well, so it's a really great project that we're setting up as, like you said, part of Music Town. And the idea kind of came from Ulysses as the piece of work. But the main thing and the biggest draw to it for us really was the different perspectives that you get throughout the book and the different kind of inner revelations that you get from the three characters, from Stephen, Bloom and Molly. So we just thought that would be really kind of, it would work really well if we were to do a similar thing in our own way by using the different perspectives and voices of modern Ireland. And we kind of done that in the way we always do, which is through hip hop and spoken word and through our collective in such a way. So it's really taken from the insights and the kind of the individualism between the three characters that you get in the book and reflecting that through, like I said, modern times and Ulysses 2021 and what that means to be introspective in this day.
Yeah, but you're doing part of what you're doing at any rate, or something you're going to do for me, I believe, this evening is part of the Ballad of Percy O'Reilly, but this is from Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, I just have to be difficult, I suppose. I can't, could never follow an instruction if I tried, but I just really like that, the sound of it. And it's a very kind of personal story that's told through the form of gossip and kind of just kind of laughter and joyous. And it's really, going back to what you were just talking about, it's really difficult to say, and I just love a challenge like that. But I think it fits as well in terms of I think I was one of the few people who actually done anything directly from Joyce or related to Joyce, but I just love this poem and I love Finnegan's Wake as well, so I did have to cheat a little bit, but I got it in there anyways.
You squeezed it in.
I did squeeze it in.
How did you first come across the poem before I get you to do a bit of it for me?
So it's the first version I ever heard of it was a Ronnie Drew version
Dublin's,
of it. Yeah, and he tells the whole story of Percy O'Reilly basically in the intro, just on YouTube one day. And then when Ronnie Drew starts doing it, that brilliant Dublin accent, because I don't know particularly what James Joyce himself sounded like, but I just imagine now in my voice, in my head, it's Ronnie Drew's voice. So that was my first kind of coming across. I haven't read the book or anything. I haven't read Finnegan's Wake, but I've read bits and pieces. And this is a poem from within the book, which Ronnie Drew turned into a song. And yeah, it's just brilliant.
Well, will you give me a little bit of your version then of the Ballad of Percy O'Reilly?
I'll give you a verse or two, yeah, while we're here. Have you heard of one Humpty Dumpty, how he fell with a roll and a rumble, and curled up like Lord Oliver Crumble, by the butt of the magazine wall, hump, helmet and all? He was one time our king of the castle, now he's kicked about like a rotten old parsnip, and from Green Street he be sent, be order of his worship, to the penal jail of Mountjoy, jailum and joy. He was for father of all things for the bodderous, slow coaches and immaculate contraceptives for the populace, mare's milk for the sick, 7 dry Sundays a week, open air love and religious reform, and religious infordum, hideous in form. So that's just the first 3 verses. The thing goes on for ages, but even for the version I've done for Music Town, I condensed it because it would take me the whole show to say it, but it's fantastic. I definitely recommend giving it a read and even trying to say it as well.
I was going to ask you about that. How important do you think it is, in general with the work of Joyce, obviously, but specifically here, but it is written as a ballad, so it's written to be performed in many ways. But saying it, speaking it, performing it out loud like that, how important is that to getting into an understanding of what Joyce is actually doing?
I think that even in my own experience, if I was to sit here and just read that in my head, I wouldn't have known what it was or what it was meant to be or what it was even saying. It would have just kind of, would have been flat. And it's very similar in that sense to spoken word, is that a lot of spoken word is written solely to be heard and to be said and performed. So I straight away kind of took a liking to it, the fact that it was a ballad, because it was, like you said, meant to be heard. And I think you get so much more out of certain things now. A lot of art forms are kind of meant to be looked at and not listened to. But in this case, it's definitely, it's vocal. And like the whole show, Ulysses 2021, is all, it's so kind of, it's visual. It was recorded beautifully, but it was also just so great to just sit and, like, you could listen and close your eyes and you'd just be taken away to wherever it takes you. And I think that's the best thing about the show that we're putting on now, is that it's really kind of auditory and gives you that taking yourself away kind of experience.
The other thing, as you were speaking it for me there, certain phrases within it, you know, even the reference to contraceptives and the reference to different aspects, different rhymes that actually Joyce puts in, they're very much like hip hop rhymes. It's not a big move in from the language of Joyce back at the beginning of the 20th century to actually speaking it out loud now in 2021.
I know, and can you imagine the reaction to something like that being read aloud in when it was released? Like, you it would have been raised a few eyebrows for sure. But that's what I always say. Everyone says kind of, oh, but is what you do poetry, or would you consider hip hop real music and all this kind of stuff? It's literally word for word can be taken from 100 years ago and it can be placed into modern day world, and it's the same thing. It's just kind of using modern slang and stuff. But definitely it was scandalous when it came out. It's still kind of scandalous now. It's a very funny story. It definitely does, everything kind of rolls around in circles and cycles like that. So yeah, definitely related.
I suppose how apt that it should be taking place in the Museum of Modern Literature, or the Museum of Literature Ireland, Molly. Obviously, you think of Molly Bloom the minute you hear that.
I know, it's brilliant, yeah.
Tebby Rex and Sasha Turfus, amongst the other performers there. So it's all in the can now, and we can watch it then, is the plan, on Wednesday the 21st. Is that it, Natalia?
Yeah, that's it. We all pre-recorded, all very COVID-friendly and all that kind of stuff, in a beautiful, beautiful location. I really recommend going to visit Molly when everyone's allowed.
Yeah, when we can get back in there. We were in there ourselves with Roddy Doyle at one point during lockdown as well, and it is a beautiful place. You're absolutely right about that. Good to speak with you this evening, Natalia, and looking forward to seeing the performance. All the best. That's Natalia O'Flaherty there, and Ulysses 2021 will be live on musictown.ie Wednesday, April 21st at 8 p.m. This evening in our Where Do I Begin slot, we consider the work of John Berger, art critic, screenwriter, novelist, documentary maker, playwright and political activist. His genre-crossing artistic output over his lifetime was award-winning and profoundly influential. He won the Booker Prize in 1972 for his novel G, also the year that he gave us his documentary series Ways of Seeing, which redefined the way we consider Western art. Joining me now, director and writer Conal Morrison, to talk about the life and work of John Berger. I suppose, Conal, the fact that that's a shortened list of the things that John Berger did is quite hard to get to grasp about just the breadth of work that's involved here.
Okay, so, I mean, that's only half the list, and he is hard to grasp almost because of the diversity of forms that he worked over, or indeed that he created, you know. So for us in a culture that privileges specialism, we almost mistrust this. You know, you can be a novelist, or you can be maybe two things, but to be so many people almost mistrust it. But he just didn't see the need to compartmentalize. He was fond of the quote from Picasso, who said, "Whenever I have something to say, I say it in the means of which it needed to be said." So he'll range over forms to find the perfect form for it, and he renewed himself as an artist and as a thinker over his long productive life. But he enjoyed sort of making connections. He wanted to connect with different forms and with different artists, because he was a great collaborator.
Before we get into the specifics of the work itself, tell me a little bit more about him, the man.
He was born in London. His paternal grandfather was from Trieste, but the family ended up in London. His father spent 4 years at the front in World War One. Very unusual to last that long. He ran away from his public school several times. Just he found it a barbaric, totalitarian regime, is how he phrased it. And he ended up in Ireland during the war. He was teaching, he refused a commission, and he was teaching PT, no less, to a bunch of kind of raw recruits outside Belfast. And he felt that that was the beginning of his proper education. He got to meet classes outside his own kind of middle class milieu. And he wrote a lot of letters for a lot of these guys whose literacy wasn't the best. So that kind of introduced him to a whole other aspect of society that then set him on a road that that he pursued. He went off to the Chelsea College of Art, painted, worked, got involved in kind of workers' education movements, and then became an art critic for the New Statesman. All during the 50s, where he was very, very controversial because he kind of favoured kind of realism over the advancing innovations of modernism or abstract expressionism. He was, you know, he was kind of hard left, and he believed that, you know, the world was visible, the world was, you know, real, and you should relate to that, and you should sort of see how can you tell the stories of real people, the felt existence, always with a view to how to change it. So he got involved in various kind of spats, fighting with, you know, all the people who were, you know, sort of saying, oh, no, listen, modernism is the way forward. But he was incredibly articulate, he was incredibly insightful, and he was incredibly kind of forthright. So the spats were loud and occasionally vicious.
And from what you're saying about those spats, Conal, to a large extent, we're talking about it wasn't just the aesthetic that he was interested in. There was very much a political drive behind his philosophies and a political drive behind the way he approached art.
Yes, very much so. And that never changed throughout his entire life. You know, he was a kind of a unrepentant Marxist. Not Marxism in the sense of this is going to be the cure for all our ills, but Marxism as a set of kind of analytic tools. So you would look at art and you would consider kind of what is the story behind that picture, or what all went into making it, or what was the reality for the artist. So that was his focus during the 50s. And he felt that, you know, the... you know, some of the innovations of abstract expressionism were kind of a fetishism of despair, you know, and he felt vindicated and a sort of a chronic sort of onanistic individualism. So he felt vindicated in later years whenever it was revealed that indeed the CIA had been backing, you know, tours of abstract expressionism and Encounter magazine that that sponsored that movement because they saw it as part of the cult of individualism. So Berger was again that.
Yeah, but how doctrinaire was he in that type of being again things, as you say yourself?
Well, I mean, in that era, he would have been coming out of the war, and a lot of his friends were emigres who had, you know, washed up in London. So he very much believed in the possibility of a revolution. All throughout his life, he was on the side of the exile and the voiceless and the oppressed, and he was very much in the forefront of that at the time. Like a lot of his generation, though, 1956 was a watershed whenever the Russians invaded Hungary. So that created a great kind of crisis of conscience and indeed of confidence in the political way forward. So he had to kind of readdress things. So, and out of that, though, came his first and one of his best novels called A Painter of Our Time. Which is
kind of where you think we should start. This is a good starting point.
Absolutely. I mean, he was so kind of prolific. We can only pick a couple of things for our chat this evening. But that novel is a piece, it's a wonderful read. There's a character called John in it, a young art critic who befriends a Hungarian emigre painter called Janos Lavin. And it's set in he comes across the diaries of this painter who we latterly discovered has gone back to Hungary to throw his shoulder to the wheel. But it's a superb piece about commitment to the artistic life and the difficulties and the doubts and the disappointments and the achievements and political commitment. So it's very moving. It's often very, very funny. There's a great sort of satire of Sir Kenneth Clarke in it. But as an analysis of the difficulties involved in the artistic life and how you can connect that into political activism and what is the trade-off between the two, it's a superb read.
And it's often a question I ask around novels and books and works of art that have this strong political content. Is there an entertainment value there as well? Is there a balance between the dialectical aspect of the book or the arguments that he's putting forward and the sheer joy of reading a story?
Oh, very much so. I mean, there is absolutely some chewy politics in it, but even that is kind of very, very bracing, you know, just in a very, very kind of relativist world now, where it's quite easy to give into a kind of political fatalism, where we kind of think, oh, well, that's it, free market capitalism has won the day, and we're screwed in the environment. Berger constantly in a book like that, and all his books says, no, go back in and fight the good fight. But he always balances his critiques with a sense of wonder, you know. Joan Didion mentioned, she said, listen, I tried to think about Hegelian dialectics, but I always found myself looking out the window at the pear tree. Berger could do both, you know. He could handle your dialectics, and he would actually write a description of the pear tree and the pear that would make you want to run out and hug the tree and lick the pear, you know. He was that good.
Now there you go. But I suppose for most people, if you say the name John Berger, Ways of Seeing will probably be the phrase that they would come up with quickly enough. 1972 television series, best-selling book, hugely influential, still probably as influential today in many ways as it was back then. What was he talking about there, and what do you think, Connell, made this such an important, such a landmark series and text?
Well, it's the range. In 4 half-hour programmes, he talks about the art and the age of reproduction, which is never more relevant given now that we can kind of, you know, see any picture that we want by simply by tapping our computer, and arguably suffer there because everything is lost in the kind of infinite cultural supermarket that we live in. He talks about the male gaze, the objectification of women through the person who's behind the camera, or the advertiser, or the portrait painter. He talks about the manipulation involved in advertising. And he talks about all the cultural history surrounding the tradition of oil painting and their inflation in the art racket. So he covers everything. It's an astonishing list.
Let's listen to a clip actually that refers to specifically to the very first thing you mentioned there, Connell, where he's considering the impact that photographic reproduction has had on the dissemination of great paintings and, as a result, the way we understand and view them.
Botticelli's Venus and Mars used to be a unique image, which it was only possible to see in the room where it was actually hanging. Now its image, or a detail of it, or the image of any other painting which is reproduced, can be seen in a million different places at the same time. As you look at them now, on your screen, your wallpaper is round them, your window is opposite them, your carpet is below them. At this same moment, they are on many other screens, surrounded by different objects, different colours, different sounds. You are seeing them in the context of your own life. They are surrounded not by gilt frames, but by the familiarity of the room you are in and the people around you.
That's John Berger, and a clip from Ways of Seeing. Connell Morrison this evening answering our Tuesday evening question, where do I begin with John Berger?
And they're showing, just to butt in, you can hear just the quality of his voice. Quite a lot of the success of him as a TV presenter is incredibly handsome, leonine face, and just the beautiful kind of timbre of that voice, you know. Simon McBurney, one of his collaborators and friends, said that Berger had a listening voice, and, you know, it doesn't quite make sense, but you know exactly what he means at the same time. You know?
1972. When you think of now, just think about what he said there about viewing things basically from your own kitchen table.
Yeah,
is what he was talking about. I mean, he died in 2017, so he would have been aware of obviously the beginning of the selfie, the iPhone, social media, etc., etc.
But the foresight is remarkable in a way. When you look at it, and I urge people to go to YouTube and see them there. It's a superb bit of viewing. But to an extent, it might almost look a little bit old-fashioned, but that's actually a mark of its achievement, because the things that he talks about we have now internalised, and they've become commonplace. Mm. Our awareness of advertising, our awareness of reproduction, our awareness of the male gaze and the objectification of women. But Berger was talking about them for the first time. You know, that's how sort of revolutionary and influential that series was.
Yeah, and that's why, as we were saying here in the studio and in the production area, as we listen to that clip, that's 1972. Yeah, and he's speaking directly to us 50 years later. It makes total sense.
It's phenomenal, absolutely. And indeed, you know, a couple of years later, after he won the Booker Prize, and we might get on to that about what he did with the prize money. But he spent half that money.
Well, in fact, just do go on to that, because I know you want to talk about the novel G, but as much, which is the novel that he won the Booker Prize for in 1972, same year as we get the TV series. But it's not so much the novel that's the story here. It is what he did with the prize money.
Yes, no, indeed. I mean, the novel has various kind of modernist manoeuvres that don't quite work for me quite as well. I prefer some of the earlier work and then the later work where he became kind of more lyrical and had strains of a kind of magical realism. But he won the Booker Prize for G, which is a kind of a retelling of the Don Juan story. But whenever he won it, at the prize giving ceremony said, "I'm giving half this money to the London branch of the Black Panthers, because Booker McConnell's sponsor at their money is based on the exploitative trade in the West Indies," and this caused major uproar. I'm giving the second half of the prize money to a collaborator, and we're going to investigate migrant labour in Germany. So he wrote a piece called The Seventh Man, which was the book that he said he was the most proud of, which explored the phenomenon of the Gastarbeiter, as they were called in Germany, all the Turks who were coming and who had to kind of uproot themselves and work there. And in some interview he says that actually if he had to identify one theme in his life, it was the experience of the exile and the migrant. So long before, you know, our consciousness has been raised about people who are forced into exile because of war or economics, Berger was there, and it's a superb book, and he kept at that theme for the rest of his life, you know.
So is that where you would send us then, as a kind of a more recent work to look at from him?
Seventh Man is fascinating, partly because of what it describes. Now it's been superseded by, you know, the migrant experience that we're all aware of, but in terms of actually him telling the stories of these people and being deeply respectful and saying you must go back to the individualism of these people and the culture that they've had to uproot themselves and the culture that they have to try and supplant themselves into. It is superb, but also that he worked with Jean Moore, the Swiss photographer who he worked with a lot. He basically invented a new form of the photo text. I mean, there have been obviously books of photographs with captions, but this was different. That Moore went off and took the photographs, Berger went off and wrote, and the text was not captions to the photographs, and the photographs were not illustrations of the text. That they were two kind of different kind of narratives. They each shouldered a different burden within the text. So he invented effectively a new form. Now he'd done that before with a wonderful book called A Fortunate Man, about a doctor in the Forest of Dean, and they did it subsequently. But it's a superb hybrid form that he virtually invented.
So is that actually one of the big attractions? It's not just that he was, you know, that he was this ability to work across disciplines. In fact, he was an invent. He constantly made forms work, or he found the form that was useful for what he wanted to say at that point in time.
Absolutely, and just saw, no reason why you couldn't invent a new form, that he would constantly kind of redraw the creative map. He was constantly interested in connections between ideas, connections between sort of art and history and politics, but connections between peoples, you know, connections between anything he could draw, and then connections obviously between the wide range of collaborators that he worked with, like Simon McBurney or Anne Michaels or various artists and so on. He felt that actually not only did this bring great creative results, he actually believed in the principle of communality, you know, that the collective mind was greater than just necessarily, you know, the dreaming up of the lone individual.
Again, the politics playing into that in many ways. Well, look, thanks for that opening up our minds to the ideas around Jorn Berger and his several areas of work, Conal. But when you're on with us, might as well say congratulations. First of all, the Abbey Theatre announced the commemoration bursary recipients. These are the bursaries that are around the commemoration of those who lost their lives on Bloody Sunday in Croke Park in 1920, and you are the recipient of one of those bursaries. Just to tell us, what will you be doing and how will these works be realised? Each one is dedicated to a particular person who died in Croke Park on that Sunday. Yours is, you accepted your bursary in the name of James Burke. Tell us a bit about him.
He was a laundry worker from Ternure who was sort of crushed effectively in the crowd, in the melee in Croke Park, left a young family behind. So I think it's a lovely idea just to dedicate these to the people who died. I think the idea is great as well. You know, people may think that, oh, listen, we're sick of the decade of commemorations, but there's a lot of questions to be asked and there's a lot of stories yet to be told. So I think it's a superb initiative by the National Theatre.
And is it a play that you're writing in the process of writing about partition?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, like a good naughty boy that I am, I'm writing about the history of partition. So I'm going to look at the sort of the basics of the political machinations, but I'm going to sort of do a twin track where I look at the kind of the felt experience on the ground, what it was like for people in Newry and Monaghan to suddenly find themselves on the side of a new dividing line. What was it like in Belfast during the riots and the pogroms that broke out when suddenly people suddenly realised that their political reality had had radically changed. So it's a historical investigation, but obviously my eye is on the fact that 100 years on, this is a far from resolved issue.
It certainly is a hot topic once again, isn't it? Well, look, we congratulations, as I say, on the receiving the bursary, Conal, you and several others who are involved in that as well. And you can find out full details about those particular awards and who got the bursaries on abbeytheatre.ie, and we'll watch out for the realisation of the projects as time passes. In the meantime, thanks for being with us this evening, Conal, and thanks for that opening up of our minds, as I say, to the work of Joan Berger. And as you probably know by now, the RTE National Symphony Orchestra are currently presenting a spring season in the National Concert Hall to an online audience. This Friday, the NSO are offering us an All-American Night with the works of Aaron Copland, Samuel Barber and John Adams. Delighted to be joined now by conductor Gavin Maloney. Why an All-American concert? How was that choice? How did you? Well, first of all, was that idea presented to you, Gavin, or was it something you wanted to do yourself?
It wasn't presented to me, Sean, but I'm very happy to be involved with it. The concert's a sort of a miniature retrospective of 20th century American music. And what's unusual about it is that America often seems to be looking forward, but this is a very reflective program. Mm. And I think it's rather looking backward.
And backward in a good way. There's a real nostalgia in particular in the backward look that we get from Samuel Barber. And I know this is one of the pieces that is really important to you and that one that you were very keen to do. Knoxville Summer of 1915. Explain the work that's involved here.
So Barber's father died in 1947 and he wrote this piece shortly afterward based on a text by James Agee. That was written 9 years earlier. And it's a kind of stream of consciousness text about a man remembering an evening in his childhood. And it's quite challenging from the soloist's point of view. The soloist is the speaker because when she sings, we have the wonderful Rachel Croatch on Friday with us. It's very hard to tell what age the person is. The language in the beginning is kind of elevated in a high register. But as we go through the piece, the child seems to get younger and younger.
Let's have a listen to the opening section, and really every time I hear this piece, you do feel yourself almost sitting down on a veranda, looking out. It's an evening type of feel to it, summer's evening. You can almost hear the crickets in the background. The opening section, or apart from the opening section of Samuel Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915, one of the pieces that the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Maloney, will be performing this Friday evening, and it'll be Rachel Croatch who will be the soloist in Friday evening's performance. There's a lovely, almost chamber feel to it. Now, obviously, because of COVID, the numbers that you can put on the stage of the National Concert Hall are limited. You have to have space between people, Gavin. But that played into, I'm sure, the choices of the music. What sort of forces are involved for the Samuel Barber piece?
For the Barber, it's essentially a string orchestra with flute, doubling on piccolo, cor anglais, clarinet, bassoon, and we've three brass and a harp. So it's really quite an intimate feel, which is really ideal for the nature of the piece.
And what about the other pieces then that you've chosen? You were saying that it's a kind of a mini history of 20th century music in America. Aaron Copland, is he the daddy of it all?
Yeah, he certainly is. And he wrote Quiet City in 1940. And it features two very lonely soloists, a lonely trumpet and a cor anglais. moving to a backdrop of very slow-moving strings. And these solo voices are very haunting. It reminds me something of, you know, an Edward Hopper painting. It's a kind of a realism and American solitude to it. And Copland, you know, we associate him with a kind of quintessential American sound. Mm. And he sort of achieves this by using space, by using open intervals and quite simple statements against his harmony.
Whenever Copland writes a piece of music, you're automatically out on a big wide open plane. I don't know how he does that. No matter what it is, you're out in a big wide open plane. That's what it often feels like. But you mentioned the play City Lights. This is Irving Welsh, Rich Man, Poor Man. People might remember that particular miniseries. It was one of the first miniseries when those things were invented. It was music originally written for a play.
That's right, yeah, but it took on a life of its own. He sort of redid it slightly in 1940, and then he said himself that it had lost all its associations with the play and become its own entity.
Mm. So if Copland, if you like, is that early part of the century, Barber kind of middle, to, early to middle, but John Adams quite definitely brings us into a different part of American music and the beginnings of minimalism, Philip Glass, and that music that we know so well.
Yeah, actually, I find it really interesting that the Copland and the Barber are only 7 years apart. But
I know.
To my mind, it sounds like they're much further apart, yeah. Like the Copland is earlier. But yeah, the John Adams is from 1987. It's called Shaker Loops. And it's in four parts. The outer parts are pretty strictly minimalist. But the main kind of excitement in the piece is the third part. And this title, Shaker Loops, it comes from obviously the shaking Quakers, that sort of association of worship, but also there's the violin technique or string technique of tremolo with the bow that creates a shaking sound, and he uses that technique a lot in the piece, so it's a kind of a pun that he was doing. But in the third section, it's where it's quite different to the rest because there are big increases in the tempo over very large stretches of time, but also sometimes over very short stretches of time. And he sort of brings us to a precipice and then lets us fall and it builds again. So it's quite arresting.
I want to go back just to finish with a piece of music, to go back to the Barber. I particularly like the second clip that we have here, in fact, which is his evocation of a streetcar. Do you maybe give us the ideas that he was trying to put across to us, particularly in this part of Knoxville, summer of 1915, Gavin?
So we've established already this kind of gently lilting rocking mood, and the child describes his parents nearby. But there's a kind of a tradition of traffic music in American music, if you think of Gershwin and the American in Paris with the car horns and that. So this is a streetcar, and you can hear that the music becomes quite agitated, sort of disturbing the peace and quiet of this child's evening. I think it's also that you get this sense of kind of the modern world intruding on another way of life.
A streetcar raising its iron wheels, stopping, bending, starting, straight through, losing and raising again, its iron increasing wheel, and sweeping its gold where it goes and draws it fast.
Yeah, very different sound indeed from the calmness of the opening of Samuel Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915. And that particular recording featured Barbara Hendricks with the London Symphony Orchestra, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting there, she and that orchestra that performed in the first section that we heard from as well. Rachel Croash will be the soloist on Friday evening with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Gavin Maloney. The concert will be streamed live from the National Concert Hall, 7 p.m. on Friday the 16th, available on rte.ie/culture, broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM.